This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everybody to episode 38 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me is Zachary Frühling. Today we'll be talking about Star Trek and the philosophical movement known as phenomenology. Zachary, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Mike. You know, it was funny, I was really torn about whether we should do an episode of Metatrex on this topic, on phenomenology, partially because I think most people who studied philosophy themselves don't even really fully understand what phenomenology is. So I have this hidden fear that I'm going to butcher our talk about phenomenology. But it's such an important movement in the history of philosophy, and it represents a shift in thinking in the history of philosophy. So I'm excited to talk about it. It's something that I feel like back when I was learning philosophy, I was excited to learn about it. There are sort of these philosophical thought experiments you can go through. In fact, we're going to do a philosophical thought experiment together a little bit later in the show. I'm going to walk you through a phenomenological thought experiment, Mike. So I'm excited, but a little nervous at the same time.
Well, I have to admit, Zachary, I'm a little nervous because as we were talking in the turbo lift, I'm going to be the guinea pig in this little thought experiment. I have to admit that I'm one of those people who have a vague understanding of phenomenology. I've read a little bit, Martin Heidegger. I know we're going to talk a little bit about some other notable people in the phenomenology movement, but I'm a little vague on this, so I'm looking forward to the discussion.
Well, I purposely didn't tell you what the thought experiment was going to be because I didn't want to ruin it. I mean, most of the time when you think about philosophical issues, you want to think about it a lot and often and beforehand and do a deep dive, right? The interesting thing about phenomenology is the emphasis on first-person, subjective, sort of objects of consciousness, you know, focusing on your own mental experience of whatever you're trying to reflect on. So I kind of don't want to spoil it for you. I really wanted to leave it unknown and so you could, you know, be a really genuine a guinea pig so we can walk through this thought experiment and you can not have an idea what's coming and you can, you know, report back on what your intuitions are and what your experience of our discussion is as we go.
Yeah, this is a great test of trust here. As we were talking, you and I have literally known each other for just a little over a year. We first met
only a year, is that true?
It's been about a year. We met on one of the patron roundtables that Trek FM did, as you and I had both entered into patronage for the network, and I was thinking about how I might be able to break into podcasting. I had such a great time. You had this phenomenal idea for a podcast, and you and I have the same inclinations as far as what we like to talk about in Star Trek, and I think we both recognize that in each other, and you gave me a shout out and said, hey, you want to go along for a ride? So this is the ultimate test of the trust that we've built over the year that we've known each other.
You sound like you're about to give a phenomenological analysis of friendship and podcasting at the same time.
Friendship, you know, it's funny. I was just saying to my wife that although you and I have never met face to face, you've literally become one of my best friends. So we're going to put this to the test.
Well, we didn't get a chance to meet each other at Star Trek Las Vegas. Unfortunately, neither one of us could go this year. But next year, we're putting it on the calendar. You know, you and I have a meetup planned. We're going to have drinks and talk about Star Trek and philosophy next time at Star Trek Las Vegas.
50 and more. Do some Klingon karaoke.
Maybe one of us will do that. Kapla with that.
Yeah. Kapla. Well, shall we dive in, Zachary?
Yeah, we should. So what I wanted to start with is just a really quick overview of what phenomenology is and how it fits into the history of philosophy. I know if you're not really a philosophy wonk, this kind of thing can be a little tedious because, you know, if you haven't studied the history of philosophy, you're not sure where a concept fits in, and you don't have kind of the big picture, long-term, you know, history of philosophy in mind, it can be a little difficult to see the significance of how a movement fits into the bigger picture. So I do want to convey a little bit of that, because I think unless you really understand what problem phenomenology was trying to solve in the history of philosophy, it can be a little difficult to understand why you should take it seriously and why it's kind of interesting. So real quickly, in order to understand phenomenology, I think you need to understand the difference between pre-Kantian philosophy and post-Kantian philosophy. We've observed before on Metatracks that the philosopher Immanuel Kant is kind of a turning point in the history of philosophy. And I think phenomenology, as an example of post-Kantian philosophy, really kind of illustrates the change that took place with Immanuel Kant. So real quickly, before Kant, in the history of modern philosophy, if you remember, the philosopher René Descartes was known as the father of modern philosophy. Mm-hmm. And he really kind of reinvigorated philosophy coming out of the medieval period with an emphasis on reason and trying to solve problems using pure reason alone, as opposed to relying on faith or on doctrine or on the church or whatnot. Descartes came along as a rationalist and said, you know, I'm going to try to see what my reason alone can tell me. And there was a reaction against that known as empiricism. So from Descartes to Kant, you were either kind of in one of two camps. You were either a rationalist or you were an empiricist. If you were a rationalist, you thought that all knowledge came from pure reason. And if you were an empiricist, you generally thought that all knowledge came from our senses or from experience. And Kant was interesting because he kind of took the best of these two views, combined them together, synthesized them in a way, and kind of recognized the best of both camps. He basically thought that our mental faculties are active in structuring the world. So the world of experience is a constructed world. You know, whatever our senses ingest, our mind takes categories like number and time and space and imposes those on whatever is out there in the real world. And we'll never know what's out there in the real world because we can't get outside of our own mental faculties, our own mental categories. But the important change that took place was that Kant introduced this idea that the world that we experience is not just a passive world that we receive, via our senses, but it's a world that our mind is active in constructing, the combination of our experience and our minds. So even though Kant was concerned with trying to preserve scientific objectivity in light of all these skeptical concerns that René Descartes raised, he was really trying to find a way for the scientific enlightenment that's taking place around him to overcome these skeptical concerns that had been raised by philosophers like Descartes. But in doing so, what he did was introduce this concept that our minds are active in constructing the world. And so he introduced subjectivity, the notion that that the subjective first-person experience is something to be analyzed, something to be taken seriously philosophically. You know, up until now, metaphysics had been trying to analyze what reality in itself is like. Kant used this phrase, things in themselves, whatever reality in itself is like, apart from our senses. And he became a total skeptic about that for the sake of focusing on the objectivity of our first-person subjective constructed experience. And that is a turning point in the history of philosophy. And from Kant, there's several different sort of threads that branch off from Immanuel Kant in philosophy. And phenomenology is one of those threads focusing on first-person experience. You get phenomenology, you get existentialism, you get the logical positivist movement, you get a whole host of different threads that spring off from Immanuel Kant. And phenomenology is one of those branches. But the defining characteristic of phenomenology is the focus on first-person conscious experience versus any sort of external world or empiricism or an attempt to figure out things in themselves in some sort of deep metaphysical sense. It's a focus on first-person experience of conscious experience of things. And that's the sort of defining characteristic of phenomenology. In fact, that's what the word means, phenomenon, an appearance. How do things appear to us in our consciousness? And that is kind of the essence of phenomenology. So I know that was a long introduction, but I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind, that this turn towards subjectivity and analyzing subjective experience is a reaction against this dualism between rationalism and empiricism, this dichotomy that had dominated the history of philosophy for a couple hundred years before phenomenology came on the scene. And so it's this turn inward into our own consciousness and our experience of consciousness that defines the movement of phenomenology.
As a philosophical school of thought, as a method of research, it's my understanding, Zachary, in its simplest terms, phenomenology is to study human phenomena without considering any questions of things like their causes, their objective reality, or even appearance, as it were. That's my simplest, probably, understanding of what this is.
Well, the philosopher that most people associate with phenomenology is the philosopher Edmund Husserl. So coming onto the scene in this post-Kantian philosophical world with an emphasis on subjectivity, what Husserl wanted to do was try to find a way to combine this notion of subjective experience and focus on that as the philosophical starting point, but without the skepticism that subjectivity usually implies. Usually when you think subjective, you think, oh, subjective, that's something so first person, so not objective that I can reject it. It's merely an opinion. But what Husserl wanted to do is focus on the way in which our consciousness has the ability to analyze concepts inside our own mental experience without relying on things in the external world, without relying on non-essential factors, and see what we can learn about reality in some sort of objective sense, purely from our mental introspection about how those objects appear to us in our consciousness. It's very interesting because it sounds like he's trying to get at the nature of things in themselves. In fact, Husserl himself said he wanted to return to things in themselves, but not in the sense of, in any sort of deep metaphysical sense. He wanted to return to things in themselves in the sense in which those things present themselves in our mental experience, the way in which you can close your eyes and get a mental picture of a concept, and you can play with different permutations of that concept, and you can get at some sort of essential truth about the nature of those concepts purely through mental analysis, without relying on empirical experience, without relying on non-essential factors. He really thought that, you know, you could take these concepts that present themselves in your mind, and you can play with them, and you can analyze them, you can try different permutations of them, and you can get at the essence of that concept using purely sort of mental faculties. And it's interesting though, because it sounds very similar to what rationalists were trying to say, that we can use our minds to get at knowledge. What the difference though is that he wanted to focus on the experience of consciousness, you know, how those objects and those properties and those concepts seem to us and present themselves to us in our experience. It's much more experiential and less sort of purely logic and analytical like the rationalists thought.
As a method of research, Zachary, I believe that there are three main postulates, one of them being logical consistency, one of them being subjective interpretation, and the other one being adequacy. That's our Kirk, Spock, and McCoy of phenomenology.
Of phenomenology? See, I guess my concern about that is that already sounds a little too analytical to me. It's accurate. And yes, those are good criteria, right? If consistency is important, if you have a contradictory view, for example, that in itself is usually reason to reject the view. So I don't think those are bad criteria. But what I do think is that doesn't capture the gestalt of phenomenology and the sort of feel of what it's like to think in a phenomenological manner. So that's why, Mike, I wanted to walk you through this phenomenological thought experiment using Star Trek as an example. And the idea came to me, I remember I was thinking back to when I first started learning about phenomenology when I was a junior in college at Sonoma State. I was in a class with a professor of mine named Philip Clayton. And I wonder if Philip Clayton listens to the show. I know he knows about the show. If you're listening to this, Philip, hello. But I remember just being totally fascinated by this idea of phenomenology, because we kind of did a version of this phenomenological thought experiment with a non-Star Trek example. And I want to kind of do that same thought experiment because it was really powerful for me. The experience of learning about phenomenology, the phenomenology of phenomenology at the time, was really powerful. It made an impression on me. I remember the example to this day, you know, almost 20 years after the fact now. So I'm excited to kind of walk you through that kind of an example and, you know, just kind of see what your experience of thinking phenomenologically is like. But with Star Trek as an example, it's such an interesting idea. Let's take that kind of experiment and let's do it with something from Star Trek. And so most of the time when we're doing a Metatrex episode, we usually like start with a concept or a problem in philosophy, or we start with a particular episode or a movie and we try to, you know, find philosophical themes or analyze some sort of example. We're going to do something a little bit different today. We're actually going to try to close our eyes and we're going to do a little bit of phenomenological meditation on some things from Star Trek. And we'll see if we can get at the essence of what those things are, purely using our first-person mental, subjective, conscious experience of those things. So as Husserl said, we should try to bracket the things that are non-essential. We should try to bracket our sensory experience, try to focus on the mental experience itself. So, Mike, no peeking, no looking at screenshots, no watching episodes of Star Trek, nothing except your own sort of first-person subjective experience in your own consciousness is allowed. So turn off everything non-essential. Don't look at the wall of Star Trek stuff I see behind you on the screen.
Okay.
Yep, no peeking. This is, if you can close your eyes, even better. It's hard to close your eyes while we're recording, but you know, ideally this is the kind of thing where we really do everything possible just to focus on the pure mental entities or the mental objects that make up the world of your experience, not focusing on anything from the senses and not focusing on anything you've
okay,
sort of
let
learned
me move my
previously.
Eagle Moss ships that are sitting right in front of me.
Yeah, you should definitely move those. That's absolutely right.
Eagle Moss.
It's funny you say that because that's exactly the kind of thing I want you to not.
So when I'm talking Trek, I like to be surrounded by Trek.
I know you do, but this is no. You really want to bracket everything Trek, so you could put
I've
it all in the closet.
I've been wanting to invest in a cosplay, so I can literally dress Trek while we're
put all of the Star Trek stuff down in the cargo bay.
All right.
When I was in college, the very simple thought experiment that we went through to learn about phenomenology was analyzing the concept of a house. And we would start by trying to get a mental picture of a house, and then you would try different permutations of that concept to see what's essential to the concept of a house and what's not. And that's the very simple house example, and that's so not Star Trek. We're going to do the Star Trek version of that. So, Mike, I want you to close your eyes, and I want you to picture a starship. You have your picture of a starship?
She's a well-endowed lady.
It's an ample starship. Okay. Well, that's all the description we need right there, right? So, Mike, I want you to describe in some detail the mental picture of the starship you just thought of.
It's white with hues of gray.
Mm-hmm.
The nacelles are, it has two nacelles, has a secondary hull, a saucer section. All of our listeners know exactly the kind of ship I'm talking about.
Yeah, this is fairly typical Star Trek fare so far. Yeah.
Bessard collectors are lit up red. Nacelles are blue.
Anything else about the shape of the starship or its... What are some of its defining characteristics in your mental picture?
Defining characteristics. It's sleek, very large and imposing.
Anything else? You know, kind of walk your way around the ship, inside or out. You know, what are some of the things that define that?
I'm doing my Star Trek the Motion Picture flyby.
Okay, that Star Trek the Motion Picture flyby. I'm writing a couple of these things down so I don't forget them. Okay.
Yeah, it has various hull markings on it.
Okay, what do the hull markings say?
Just curious. Well, there's a Starfleet Delta shield and some pinstripe lines. The Delta is yellow, the lines are red.
Which era is this starship from?
This starship is from the original series motion picture era.
Okay. I think that's enough to start working with here. So that is your mental picture of a starship. So what phenomenology would try to do is now sort of selectively try to bracket out the things that are non-essential to the concept of a starship. Change some of the permutations, you know, change things like the color, change things like the shape of the nacelles, and see what defines the essence of a starship and what you can really strip out. So you have an example of a starship, but now if we want to analyze the concept of a starship, what is a starship? Can we use our mental faculties alone to kind of get at the essence of it? So I'm just going to throw something simple out there. Like, what if the starship was a different color? What if it wasn't white? What if it was gray? What if it was a darker, almost black or a dark gray, like we saw in Star Trek Into Darkness? You know, would that still be a starship?
Absolutely.
I think that's an obvious one, right? Absolutely, that would still be a starship. So what's interesting is we just learned something interesting about the essence of a starship. We've learned that color is a non-essential attribute to the essence mm-hmm. of a starship. And we didn't need to go out and do research. We didn't need to do a scientific experiment. We didn't need to do a poll. We can rely totally on our world, our mental world, to analyze that concept and learn that new fact, this mental fact about starships, that starships are not, the color is not essential to the concept of a starship as it presents itself to us in our experience. So let's do a few more of these. Okay, you mentioned that the starship has two nacelles. What if it had three nacelles?
We've seen examples of that in the Star Trek universe. Four nacelles. Nacelles.
Absolutely. So the number of nacelles, again, is not essential to the concept of a starship. What if it didn't have, let's try something else. That's an obvious one. I think, you know, different number of nacelles, no problem. We've even seen starships that don't really have nacelles per se, right? You could have no nacelles and still technically be a starship.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't, may not be a typical Federation starship, but it could still be a starship. Ferengi ships come to mind, right? That's an example of a starship that doesn't sure. have nacelles per se. So let's think about this a little bit. What if it didn't have warp drive at all?
Yeah, it could still be a starship. It just wouldn't be a warp-capable starship.
it wouldn't go very far.
it would be limited to our own solar system at impulse.
I guess that's an interesting ambiguity. This is something I want to dwell upon. My gut reaction was, well, a starship kind of implies interstellar travel. So if you don't have something like warp drive and you're limited to impulse, would that even be a starship in any sort of meaningful sense?
Well, you raise an interesting point, because there have been references, especially in Enterprise, where they are referencing Enterprise as being unique as a starship because it is warp 5 capable. So I think an argument could be made that without warp drive, without the ability to travel at least at some warp factor, you are limiting yourself to a single star system with only impulse drive. So yeah, that's an interesting question. Would that be a starship?
But see, what I want to focus on now is how we go about answering that question. So you referred to some things in Star Trek. I see you with your eyes open. Your eyes aren't closed. So try to focus sort of purely on the mental world of your experience. Can you envision this starship, this supposed starship with no warp engines, being limited to whatever sphere it can travel within at, you know, impulse speeds, maybe even low impulse speeds, even high impulse speeds. Why not? Is this new mental picture of this ship that you have in mind, does that meet the criteria for a starship as you see this alternative ship with no warp drive in your mind?
Well, as I think about that concept, Zachary, there would no longer be a need for nacelles. Frankly, there would probably be no need for a secondary hull. So you would have something that would more resemble either an airplane, such as a space shuttle.
Yeah, I was thinking of the space shuttle myself. I have my eyes closed now, and I'm thinking of the space shuttle.
Indeed, I'm thinking of something that looks more like the space shuttle. It could possibly look something similar to what we would think of when we think of the saucer section, perhaps, of the 1701D. But I'm actually picturing something more like the space shuttle, because it would have the ability to travel both in space and be able to travel suborbital.
But in my mind, it seems pretty clear that it would be hard to make a case for that as a starship in any sort of Star Trek sense.
Well, I think we've left the definition of starship and we've created a spaceship, and I think there's a distinction there.
Absolutely. And I love this, because we're making these good conceptual distinctions. We have different mental pictures emerging as we try these different permutations. And I think you're getting at something of the essence of the experience of doing phenomenology and doing this. We're trying these mental permutations, selectively bracketing out what we can bracket out, and see if we can learn either something essential about the nature of the concept or make some important conceptual distinctions. And that really does result in knowledge. I think we've learned something by going through that experience. And we're not done. Let's try to think what else we could modify in this picture of a starship. Why don't you try? You know, what are some things you would think to naturally sort of select and vary, and you know, try some different permutations of this basic vision of a starship you have in your mind?
Well, as I was talking about the starship, I talked about the nacelles, but I didn't describe the shape of the nacelles. We oftentimes think of nacelles as being either cigar-shaped, you know, cylindrical in some shape or form. Even if they're not cylindrical, they're long and boxy, rectangular. But is that necessary, Zachary? I'm thinking, you know, could perhaps nacelles take on a different shape? Maybe the nacelles could be more boxy.
I'm picturing like some Art Deco angular nacelles.
Yeah, triangular.
Well, it's interesting because when you're talking about like a real object, I think like a starship, you know, what would be a physical object in the world, right? There are some basic sort of physics restrictions you have to take into account, right? You know, whatever mechanism allows warp drive to work, the nacelles would presumably at least have to meet those criteria, right? They have to work as nacelles. And if they don't work as nacelles, unless they're really nacelles and make the starship go, then they don't meet the criteria of a starship. So there are some restrictions presumably about however the physics behind warp drive works. And of course, this is all fictional and we don't really know how that would work, but whatever those basic laws of nature that allow warp drive to work, you'd have to take that into account when you're defining a nacelle, presumably. But, you know, from a mental picture of a starship standpoint, I think you're right. It probably doesn't matter what shape the nacelles are, as long as they still function like nacelles and make the starship go.
Well, Zachary, if I can break into a little analysis here, I think that's one of the things that I appreciate as a fan so much about Doug Drexler's design, original design of the NX-01, distinguished from the NX-01 refit that I know is very, very popular. But what Doug did when he created the NX-01 is he really redefined what a Star Trek starship looks like without completely breaking the mold. Again, it's what I really appreciate about it. The struts, for instance, that hold the nacelles, they're not the traditional struts that we got used to. There is no secondary hull. It's very similar to other Federation starships that we're familiar with, but it's also very, very different. And I know that for some fans like myself, that, you know, that was a very positive thing, and I reacted very well to it. I love the NX-01. It's by far my favorite ship in the fleet, but I know for a lot of other fans that, you know, that was a punch in the gut.
And it's funny you say that, because I think every time there's a new starship revealed, every Star Trek fan who cares about starships goes through their own little phenomenological analysis of what it means to be a starship, right? Mm. You know, everyone has their own mental picture of the ideal starship. Everyone has an expectation about what a starship should look like based on whatever that mental picture of an idealized starship is. And if something doesn't meet that criteria, they go, that doesn't look like Star Trek, or that doesn't look like a starship to me, or that doesn't look like a Federation ship to me, or that looks like, you know, fill in the blank, right? And you can see Star Trek fans kind of having this discussion amongst themselves about what it really means to be a Federation starship. And again, I don't really have a huge iron in this fire. You know, I'm kind of a starship wonk. I like seeing the different designs. On the other hand, you know, I'm open to some variation to various degrees. I think fans are open to the idea that, you know, they have to look a little different. Otherwise, they'd all look the same, right? So, but I think everyone has this idealized picture of, you know, which starship they'd want to be on and what it looks like to be a starship in the Federation or in the Star Trek universe. So I think you're right. You know, this is something we all kind of go through every time we see a new starship. But I guess the question is this is where I think phenomenology is really useful, because phenomenology gives you the tools to kind of answer this question: what things really are essential and what things really are not essential. Like, okay, I'm going to give you another mental picture to start with here, Mike. Okay. Put yourself inside the ship somewhere. Mm-hmm. Where are you?
I am in a corridor.
It's funny, I sort of feel like we're in the 1960s doing like a guided meditation with a guru or something. You know, we're actually back in the 1960s right now.
I should be burning incense or something, right?
I'm the guru. There's some incense burning over in the corner, and we're gonna, you know.
I'm suddenly hearing sitar music.
Yes, there's some sitar music, and we're going to talk about the phenomenology of Star Trek. I swear we're not hippies. Right? We're not in that hippie episode of Star Trek, are we? okay, so I'm sorry. You said where you were. Where are you?
I'm in a corridor, and I know that probably comes as a shock that I'm not standing on the bridge, but I am in a corridor.
Okay, so this is fascinating. So I went, so kind of describe where in a little more detail. You're in a corridor, but what are some of the things you see around you and whatnot?
Yeah, the walls are gray. There's no carpet on the floor. This isn't the 1701D. There's no carpet on the floor, no carpet on the walls. It's very industrial in the feel of it. In fact, the floors have more of a grating on it. It's textured metal, very cold. Everything feels kind of cold. There are various lights along the perimeter near the ceiling. Those lights are pointing me in a particular direction. Everything feels, again, very industrial.
So trying to focus as much as possible on your own mental picture that you just described, mm-hmm. Try to give me a bit of a list. Like, what are some of the things that are non-essential that you could strip away and still be on in a starship, in a sort of a functional, you know, conceptually robust starship? What are the things you can't live without? What of those things you just described are absolutely essential for an object being a starship based on your mental permutations of this experience?
There doesn't need to be lights near the perimeter of this near the ceiling pointing me in any particular direction. You do need to have some type of illumination in order to make your way around. That's necessary, but you know, lights that conveniently point me towards something that's not fundamentally necessary.
We might be in year of hell with no lights at all.
Year
right?
of hell, no lights. The floor I described as being graded, having texture. I don't know that that's particularly necessary. It could be a flat, smooth surface.
What if it didn't have a floor at all?
Well, I guess there would be.
Let me ask it a different way. What deck are you on?
What deck am I on?
Yeah, you're on a starship, right? Where are you?
I'm on B deck.
What if there were no decks at all?
What if there was one single deck? Yeah.
It might not be a very tall starship, but I think you could have a starship with only one deck.
No, it would be a very
tall
starship. I think the floors are necessary though, because they're unless there's no gravity, Zachary. If there's no gravity, then I suppose you don't need floors.
I'm gonna throw you for a little bit of a loop here. What if you are Lieutenant Commander Flipper? Does Lieutenant Commander Flipper need floors?
No, but I sure could use some water.
I think you hit on something though. We may not need floors, but we might need life support. It's hard to imagine a functioning starship with no life support.
Indeed.
Would it be a starship? I mean, it may not be a starship for humans. Data could be on a starship with no life support. You could mm-hmm. have a ship full of androids.
Yep. The doctor doesn't need life support.
So, Mike, this is really interesting to me. When I first started running my own little version of this thought experiment in my mind as we're having a discussion, my gut was telling me that a life support is essential to a starship. But as I tried different permutations in my mind, we realized, well, we could have a starship full of androids. We could have a starship full of holograms. None of those require life support. So, sure, it seems like we can have a starship without life support. They would still meet all the necessary criteria for a starship. And that was counter to my intuition. But as I used my mental faculties to try these permutations, I learned something there about that. Same thing with the floor, right? You know, we originally said, oh, sure, how can you have a starship without floors, right? Until you start to think, well, what if there's an aquatic life form like Lieutenant Commander Flipper down in Cetacean Ops? Or what if there's some sort of avian life form that just flies around the ship and doesn't need a floor, right? So we're starting to learn that some of these things that are part of our initial mental picture are not actually necessary to the concept of a starship. So we can bracket those away. And the idea is to try to get at this core essence of a concept of a starship, bracketing away all the non-essentials to get a progressively purer and purer concept of what the ideal starship would be. Ideal in the sense of, you know, bracketing away all the non-essentials, not relying on things that are non-essential. And it's funny, we were talking about the shapes of starships, because it's funny that we're right around the corner from Star Trek Discovery coming out. And there's this debate about the the ship design for Star Trek Discovery. Some people like it, some people don't. And it's funny to see people point to different features. Oh, they don't like the fact that the nacelles look like they're Klingon, or they don't like the color of it, or they don't like whatnot. And then you start to realize, hey, a lot of these things are just non-essential to the concept of a starship. We can have a Federation starship that has a slightly different color or has a slightly different shape to it. We may not have seen it before. It may not match our initial mental expectations based on all of our past experience. But if you start to bracket out that past experience and you bracket out the things that are non-essential, that ship starts to look a lot more appealing and fits alongside everything else, because its defining characteristics are non-essential. It can still be a Federation starship, because a lot of the things that people like or don't like to various degrees about the new design rely on things that are frankly non-essential to the concept of a starship. And I think we learned something about that in thinking about this mental experiment of a starship here today.
Exactly. And we're seeing a lot of the same debate that we saw when Enterprise first came out, the same type of debate. Well, you know, it doesn't have a secondary hull. It's not this, it's not that, it's not white, it's not... And so a couple of weeks ago, you and I were recording an episode of Metatrex, and we captured a screenshot, as we often enjoy doing, to kind of tease our listeners a little bit and the folks over on the Babel conference. And I had two ships together. Flip Dorsey, our good friend over at Warp 5, he got into a little game of Caption This, and you know, this is how starships are made. But the point that I was making there was that it was an interesting design that almost had an appearance that it was a hybrid of sorts from a Klingon battle cruiser and a Federation ship. And I found that very interesting. So yeah, when you think about what's essential and what isn't essential to a starship, it occurred to me, Zachary, when you were talking about life support, you know, life support, even if it were a human starship, isn't necessarily essential, because we could have the ability to operate that starship while wearing some type of biosuit.
Or we could operate it remotely via some sort of remote consciousness link.
Indeed.
Yeah, you can imagine, you know, 10 or 20 different versions of this if we tried hard enough, right? So, okay, we've learned something. We've learned life support is not essential to a starship. And I think, you know, we could spend another hour doing this and try different permutations, but I think the point is coming across that using purely our mental faculties, trying different permutations and selectively changing or bracketing certain components of this mental vision that we have of a starship, we can learn something about the concept of a starship. And I think the danger here in using a starship as an example is this sounds, in a way, really as esoteric, right? Okay, why is phenomenology valuable to analyze starships? I think if you take that idea that you can rely on conceptual analysis to get at the truth of something, you can apply this to all kinds of more important concepts and more important dilemmas in ethics and in metaphysics than starships. You know, you can take an ethical dilemma, and you can say, okay, in fact, you could probably come up with one right now. Like, okay, in the Star Trek universe, close your eyes and think of an ethical dilemma in Star Trek. What would a typical Star Trek ethical dilemma be?
Do we help or do we jump to warp and leave the system? And let the two species fight it out.
So that's pretty generic. So again, I want you to kind of focus on a mental picture now. So where are we? What's the dilemma? What are some of the details of this example?
Yeah, we are in an uncharted region of space. We have just made first contact with a new species. And in making first contact with them, we have provoked an attack from a rivaling system, only to find out that these two neighbors have been at war for 100 years.
So now the interesting question in my mind is, what would phenomenology have to say about this kind of dilemma? The situation you just described, what features of that are essential to a certain ethical outcome? And what features can be abstracted away? In other words, what's really essential to answering the dilemma, and which features can be stripped out? What are the distractions versus what are the essentials of that scenario?
Well, it's essential that we've made first contact, because frankly we have, and we can't undo that. I think the non-essentials are, you know, where do we go from here? Do we continue that relationship, or do we say, sorry, we got involved, and again, leave the system? So I think our next move is the non-essential there. When you talk about the dilemma itself, you know, we could try to broker peace. There are a dozen different scenarios of things that we could possibly do, things that, you know, perhaps would not be ethical. For instance, you know, training our weapons and fighting for, you know, one species or the other. That would, I think most fans, most folks listening to our show are going to say, no, that's not the right thing to do. And I concur.
So I think what I want listeners to take away from this kind of discussion about an ethical dilemma like this is you can apply the same kind of phenomenological analysis, not just to objects like starships. I think it's interesting. You know, I think you and I like talking about starships and their different permutations and varieties and shapes. And I think we can learn something interesting about the concept of a starship. We could take any other object in the Star Trek universe. We could do the same kind of analysis with it. But I think where phenomenology really becomes interesting is when you start to apply it to abstract concepts. What are the essential characteristics of truth, or what are the essential characteristics of something beautiful, or what are the essential characteristics of something just, or something immoral or moral, right? These are things that are, it's very difficult to get a handle on the essence of those concepts. And by trying different examples, selectively modifying the attributes of those examples, you know, modifying the permutations, you know, the severity of the situation or the consequences or whatnot, you can kind of whittle down and get a sort of purer and purer sense of what the essence of that ethical dilemma is. And it seems like you can apply the same kind of phenomenological analysis to anything you want. It doesn't have to be a concrete object. It could be an abstract concept or an ethical dilemma. And it's hard to do because I think this is something we don't have a lot of practice at. I think when you do philosophy, you know, a little bit of this is habitual. Let's try this kind of hypothetical situation or that kind of hypothetical situation. But really, we don't take a lot of time just to focus on the sort of the mental experience of those different permutations and systematically try to bracket out things that are non-essential to get a progressively purer and purer concept out of it. It really takes some mental concentration and effort, and it's kind of like guided meditation. It is kind of like sitting here, you know, strumming some guitar and listening to some sitar music and you know, having some incense burn in the other side of the room, right? that kind of environment is conducive to doing a phenomenological analysis. You do need to kind of close your eyes and bracket out all of the things you usually rely on to make your shooting from the hip reactions and judgments about things. So Mike, earlier though, you mentioned that there are sort of three criteria or three postulates used in talking about phenomenology. And this is something I probably should know having studied philosophy, but if I did know it at one time, I've forgotten it. So I can't wait to hear what you came up with.
Yeah, so as I mentioned before, when we're talking about phenomenology as a method of research or as a school of thought, there are really three postulates that you can use. And one of those would be logical consistency. The other one would be subjective interpretation, and the other one would be adequacy. And as I mentioned, these are the Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, I think, of phenomenology. So when I think about those, and the reason why I call these the Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, because geniusly in the original series, we got to look at these ethical dilemmas that they found themselves in through the eyes of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy oftentimes. And they each had a unique way of looking at the problem. And this is the way that we as Star Trek fans really got used to analyzing situations through the eyes of adequacy. Captain Kirk, is the action that I'm going to take adequate? Is the firepower that I'm going to use adequate? Is the decision that I'm going to make here adequate? I think that was the driving force for Captain Kirk. At every turn, he wanted to make sure that he did whatever he had to do to get his ship and crew through it. It was all about adequacy. And oftentimes, he threw logic and subjectivity out the door. It was just purely existential in his approach. It was all about adequacy. I mentioned logical consistency. I think obviously there's the Spock. You know, we're talking about is the logic being applied sound? Can you process this situation from start to finish with a clean course of logic? Logical consistency. And then, of course, Dr. McCoy. For Dr. McCoy, and for that matter, I think it's true of anybody who is a physician, a nurse, a clinician, you know, you rely a great deal on subjectivity. You ask your patients, for instance, how does that feel? Can you tell me what do you think if you're a psychiatrist or a psychologist? You know, what comes to mind when you think about that childhood memory? So it's all about subjectivity. And so Dr. McCoy oftentimes commented based on his own subjective interpretation of what was going on. He would approach everything in a very subjective manner. It was all about, you know, how he felt personally, how it tasted, how it looked, how it sounded. It was very subjective. So you had that subjective interpretation. And so we as Star Trek fans really got to see how they broke these moral dilemmas down, these different situations that they found themselves in, and even the way that they looked at the human experience in the confines of Star Trek, by using, really, Zachary, these three postulates: adequacy, subjective interpretation, and logical consistency.
You know, it's funny, as you were talking about these three different criteria, I was thinking about how they apply to the kind of phenomenological analysis we were doing earlier. You know, if I asked you to close your eyes and say, okay, picture a planet. Okay, that planet is round, right? Now, spherical, more or less. Now, can that planet be cubical shaped at the same time?
No.
Probably not, right? Right. It's logically inconsistent, right? So if you come up with a mental picture like that, you know, hey, I've got this planet I discovered, and it's round, and it's also a cube. Check it out. You know, what would Spock say to that, right? Someone like Spock or Data, one of these, you know, logical, you know, analysis characters would say, that's a highly illogical vision you've got there.
Curious.
So, you know, you can use... I think you can use this criterion of logical consistency to reject certain attempts to analyze a concept. You know, if your mental picture or the way in which a concept presents itself to you subjectively contains an inherent contradiction, that means you haven't got at the essence of that concept yet. There's something wrong, something that needs to be changed or something that needs to be bracketed out, and you haven't got at the essence of it yet. So, and I think this is, I think any philosopher who's not a radical subjectivist, and especially phenomenologists, I think, would accept this. They would say that, you know, truth requires logical consistency. If you have an inconsistent view, you don't have the truth of the matter yet, regardless of what concept you're trying to analyze. And we just use the stupid example of a planet that's spherical and also cubical, but you can apply that to any other concepts we've talked about. You know, if there's an ethical dilemma and there's some sort of contradiction in the situation at play, you need to play with the permutations of that dilemma in your mind a little more. If you have a picture of a starship that contains an internal contradiction in some way, you haven't got at the essence of a starship yet. So, you know, whatever concept you come up with at least has to meet the criterion of logical consistency. Adequacy, I think, is an interesting concept because, in my mind, adequacy implies, you know, how adequate is the concept you're trying to analyze for, you know, covering all the cases it's supposed to cover. Like, you know, when you have a concept of a starship in mind, it needs to be adequate to encompass all of the things that really genuinely do count as starships, right? Your first person subjective mental picture of a starship doesn't encompass some actual starships out there in universe now, right? You know, if you said a starship requires two nacelles, and that's my picture of a starship, and that's got to be the essence of a starship, it has to have two nacelles, and that's part of your mental picture of an ideal starship, and then that doesn't cover some other real starships like the Stargazer with four nacelles, right? You'd say that's not an adequate concept. It doesn't cover all the examples that it needs to encompass. And likewise, it needs to not cover too much, right? It shouldn't be such a broad concept that it covers things that aren't starships. It shouldn't cover spaceships, and it shouldn't cover shuttles, and it shouldn't cover photon torpedoes, and right, there's lots of things that are included in the concept of a starship and excluded from the concept of a starship. So adequacy in my mind means, are you encompassing all the right things, all the actual starships, and are you rejecting the things that aren't genuine starships from your mental picture of a starship? So sort of conceptual adequacy is what I hear when I think of the term adequacy.
Well, funny enough, I think Captain Kirk made that point to his crew. You know, a ship is a ship. So at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if it looks like a Federation ship. It doesn't matter if it's pretty. It doesn't matter if it smells. It doesn't matter. A ship is a ship.
And I think the third criterion, subjectivity, is really important. This is one of the defining characteristics of phenomenology in particular, because any philosopher, regardless of which school, is generally going to say logical consistency is important. And any philosopher is going to say, yeah, it's important for concepts to be adequate and encompass the right kinds mm-hmm. of things and exclude the other kinds of things. And that's what it means to understand a concept. If your concept is too broad, it covers too much, you don't understand the concept yet. If it's too narrow and doesn't encompass enough, then it's again, you don't understand the concept. But subjectivity is one of the defining characteristics of phenomenology. Think how many ways we learn things in the world. We learn what people told us in school. We rely on our experience. We rely on not well thought out judgments. These are things. The word knowledge is such a vague term for most of us. It encompasses so many different kinds of things. It's not clear at all what it means. And yet, there's all these things we think we know. What a phenomenologist is telling you to do is to try to bracket out all of these non-essentials, right? Forget about what you heard about in school. Forget about what you've read about. Forget about the things that your senses could be lying to you about. Focus on the mental experience, because that's where you can get some degree of, I'm going to say certainty because that sounds a bit too much like rationalism, but that's where you can get some degree of competency and fluency in a concept, is not by focusing on those things, but by focusing on how those concepts or those objects present themselves to you subjectively in the first person experience. Not even in the sensory sense, in the mental sense. Like, close your eyes and, it could be a fire truck, it could be a starship, it could be an ethical mm-hmm. dilemma. Don't read about it in books. Don't listen to what the politicians say. Don't listen to other philosophers. Close your eyes and think of some examples and selectively try to get at the truth of the matter. And that's going to be a much more reliable means to getting at the truth than any of these other methods.
Well, I think observation is the key, though. I think oftentimes we try to approach things through secondhand information. We try to approach things by comparing them to the past. We've always done it that way, so this is the way we need to do it. And again, I think if we apply these three postulates, I think we can, and let's take this and apply it to Star Trek, we can really come up with a Star Trek that's out of the box. And frankly, I'm hoping to some degree, as we move forward with Star Trek Discovery, I hope what we've seen so far, and I know there have been some really mixed reviews on what we've seen so far, I really hope that it's Star Trek out of the box, because I think, Zachary, if we can apply this thought experiment that we just kind of did for our listeners here, if we kind of apply this and peel things down to the essentials and then build upon that, I think we can come up with something that's really new, really fresh, but still very true to the original concept of Star Trek.
Yeah, and I think you're hitting on something that, we as fans do this a lot. We debate about what Star Trek means and what we like to see in Star Trek. But if you really kind of close your eyes and do this phenomenological analysis on the concept of Star Trek, the franchise itself, you can ask yourself, what components of any sort of fictional story make for Star Trek reliably, right? What are the things that you can separate that are really non-essential to Star Trek? Like, there was this crisis in Star Trek. The first time there was a Star Trek without the Enterprise, right? And even before that, how can you have Star Trek without Kirk and Spock? Way back to 1987 when the Next Generation happened, right? People were going through this very phenomenological crisis, right? Star Trek requires Kirk and Spock and McCoy. And if I don't have that, it's not Star Trek. And of course, we've seen, most of us have rejected that view, and we realize there's some essence of Star Trek that Star Trek The Next Generation captured that didn't need those specific characters. Back in 1987, if they relied on their 21 years of experience of Star Trek up to that point, from the beginning of the original series up to the beginning of The Next Generation, if you'd been a strong empiricist and relied solely on your previous experience, you might reject the Next Generation as viable Star Trek. And I think a lot of fans of the original series did that when The Next Generation came out. And most of them, of course, became fans of The Next Generation and other series as well. But I think, if you really toss it around your mind, you can go, yeah, okay, you can have great Star Trek without Kirk and Spock and McCoy. We've seen, how many other episodes of Star Trek and how many movies have not had Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and they're all great Star Trek. What kinds of things can you not do without in Star Trek? You know, I can imagine the Enterprise. Okay, yeah, we can do without the Starship Enterprise. There's been plenty of great Starship, great Star Trek with no Enterprise in it. You can have other starships, or you can have a space station, or you can have, you could have any other number of things, but none of them require the Enterprise to have Star Trek. And again, that's counterintuitive if all your previous experience had been the original series. So for us today, Mike, with having had, you know, 750 hours of Star Trek on television and 13 Star Trek movies, what of those things are essential to the Star Trek universe that if we didn't have them, we just plain wouldn't have Star Trek anymore? And what of those things are non-essential that we can bracket out and create some space for something really new that adds something to the Star Trek universe, but is totally in line with the essence of Star Trek? And I think some of those things will be tangible and some of those things will be intangible. Like in my mind, it would be hard to have Star Trek without something reliable in the Star Trek universe. You need the Federation, mm-hmm. or you need the Klingons, or you need something to anchor it in the Star Trek universe. And if you just took all of those out, it might as well be Babylon 5, or it might as well be Lost in Space, or it might be might as well be some other universe, right? You have to have something that grounds it in the Star Trek universe. So that's something tangible in my mind, something that gives us the visual or the cultural anchor points. It also, in my mind, requires some abstract things. I think Star Trek requires something of an adventure. It requires something of entertaining philosophical ideas and ethical dilemmas. I think if you veered away from that too much, you might call it Star Trek, but whether it would be genuine Star Trek or not. And this is kind of the mental gymnastics you have to do with phenomenology. Close your eyes and go, what if it was Star Trek that was purely an adventure story that didn't do philosophy or didn't do ethics or didn't do politics, right? Would that be Star Trek? They might call it Star Trek, but does it violate something of the essence of Star Trek? You know, from our first person subjective viewpoint.
What, Zachary, if it were a Star Trek with a lead female who isn't a captain?
Well, and what's funny, I thought you were gonna start talking about Captain Janeway at first. What if you had a starship captain who was a female, right? There were people that didn't like that when Voyager came out.
Sure.
And of course, in retrospect, that's ridiculous. And we've learned that, you know, having a male captain is not an essential characteristic of Star Trek, not by a long shot, right?
I think Kate Mulgrew would agree with you wholeheartedly.
Everyone would agree. Everyone worth their salt would agree with that, right? And if you fast forward 20 years and ask that question now, what do we even need a captain to have good Star Trek? You know, can we focus on a different kind of character in some way?
Well, I think we're going to find out with Star Trek Discovery in a few months.
Exactly. But we're going through the same kind of gymnastics though, right? Is this real Star Trek or is this not real Star Trek? Is this going to meet my subjective vision of what I want Star Trek to be? Or is this not going to meet my criterion of what I want Star Trek to be? And then there's the shooting from the hip response. And then there's really focusing on it and saying, well, let me think about this a little bit. What if we didn't have a captain in Star Trek? Could I tell a good Star Trek story with no captain? I think, yeah, you can very easily, I think, come up with you know, hundreds of story ideas that don't require a captain to be good Star Trek stories. And so in my mind, it's just obvious that this doesn't violate anything really essential about Star Trek. It's just a different version of it than what we've seen before. But if it has adventure and it entertains exploration, it entertains some moral and ethical and philosophical issues and, you know, makes for good drama and with compelling characters, there's these things are much more essential to the essence of Star Trek than any particular character or any particular role on a ship.
I love the stories like Lower Decks that tell the stories of other Starfleet officers, crewmen even. I mean, they don't have to be commissioned officers. One of the reasons why I love Chief O'Brien, at least the Deep Space Nine version of Chief O'Brien, is that he is an enlisted man. He's not an officer. He's a petty chief, and I love that because we're telling the story of someone who just enlisted in Starfleet and he's done his service, and you know, guess what, he went above and beyond, he was decorated by the Federation, and now he's the chief of operations on a space station.
Wait, I got to push back a little bit. What is wrong with Chief O'Brien and the Next Generation being happy in the transporter room, just beaming people from A to B and having a nice day?
Well, he's a lieutenant, then he's an ensign, he's a lieutenant again. Somebody needs to make up the mind on what is it. I'd like to know what he did to lose his pip.
Are we doing a phenomenological analysis of Chief O'Brien?
Does Chief O'Brien need to be?
Is his rank essential to being Chief O'Brien? Obviously not.
Obviously not. Because, frankly, to a lot of fans, there may be even some of our listeners, Zachary, listening to this going, wait a second, Chief O'Brien wasn't a Chief Petty Officer on The Next Generation?
I love this. The phenomenology of Chief O'Brien. We have to write that book.
Essential Chief O'Brien.
Well, Mike, we've been talking about phenomenology in Star Trek for almost an hour now. Do you have any final thoughts? Do you want to send us away with any inspirational phenomenological insights based on our discussion here today?
Well, Zachary, it'll be a couple of hours for me to kind of air the incense off my clothes. But I do want to say that this was really interesting, and I think that, especially in light of Star Trek Discovery, as if our listeners couldn't tell, I'm excited to be able to talk about Star Trek Discovery. With all of that on the horizon, and you know, recently some news has started to leak out, and we're starting to get an idea about the time frame and the characters and so on. As these things start to come out and fans begin to react, I just hope that fans will stop and close their eyes and just think about what is essential Star Trek. What is it that's essential to Star Trek? And just give this a chance and not jump to any conclusions and, you know, the usual boycotting, because I think history has proven to us time and time again that yes, you can have Star Trek without Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, although we all love Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. You can have Star Trek without the Enterprise. You can have Star Trek without a male captain. In fact, you don't necessarily need a captain to have Star Trek. You don't need to have a starship to have Star Trek. You can put it on a space station, and it would be successful. You can put an African-American in charge of that space station, and it will be wildly successful. Hey, you can get a woman with a male first officer and put her out in the middle of nowhere, nowhere near the Federation, and it'll be successful. We all love Star Trek, and we love all of the iterations of Star Trek. That's something that even the most docile of fans will say, you know, I love Star Trek. And I think as we look forward to, you know, a fourth movie in the Kelvinverse, and we look forward to Star Trek Discovery, I think we're going to see more of the same. I think we're going to see Star Trek out of the box a little bit, but at the end of the day, it's still going to be Star Trek, this wonderful wagon train to the stars, examining and exploring the human condition. And that's what it's all about for me.
You know, it's interesting you say that, Mike, because as you were talking, it occurred to me that all of Star Trek itself is a kind of phenomenological analysis of the human condition. You know, insofar as Star Trek continually tries to push the boundaries in terms of what society will accept and what society won't accept, you know, if there were people that really wouldn't entertain the idea of a female captain, and there were people that wouldn't entertain the idea of Star Trek on a space station, you know, commanded by an African-American. And at every turn, Star Trek has tried to be as inclusive and as diverse as possible because it pushes back against the norms of society and allows for a more tolerant world. And by pushing the boundaries and trying different permutations, what if we had Star Trek like this? And what if we had Star Trek with these kinds of characters? And what if we had Star Trek in this situation? What if we explored this kind of, you know, socially unacceptable experiment in Star Trek, right? This is the same kind of selective conceptual analysis we were doing with the starship. We're analyzing the human condition and what's essential to a good society and what's not essential to a good society. And Star Trek is basically doing phenomenology. And I think that's a fascinating way to look at it, because that gives license, even encourages you know, whoever takes the mantle to continue the coming up with Star Trek stories, future TV shows and future movies, hopefully many more to come beyond Star Trek Discovery. hopefully whoever continues the franchise will continue that, because I think that these different permutations help to move our vision of what the future could be forward in some way, and that gets at the truth of what the human race could be in some essential sense. And it takes that pushing back and these different playful permutations of those possibilities to get at the truth of that matter. Beyond. And for me, philosophically, I think phenomenology is a really interesting movement in the history of philosophy, because it's not obvious at all how you combine these different concepts together into a coherent worldview. We have the world we experience. We have our mental world. We have this concept of truth, and we have a concept of ideals, and we have this concept of an essence of a concept. And how does all of this fit together in the first person experience, in a lived life where we have a consciousness and we can think about these things in our minds? How do you combine all those different factors together into a whole? And phenomenology is just one approach to try to combine these different seemingly contradictory features of our experience into a coherent worldview. And in the history of philosophy, it's important because it lays the groundwork for the existentialist movement. The existentialist movement grew out of phenomenology. Phenomenology, after Kant, laid the groundwork for focusing on subjectivity. And the existentialists just ran with that hog wild and said, it's all about first-person subjectivity, so much so that you have radical freedom to do anything you want with responsibility totally on your shoulders, and everything else is a distraction. And so the existentialist just grew right out of the phenomenological movement. So it's important in the history of philosophy. But for me, I like its sort of weird 1960s meditative feel. You know, for me, it always did have this, and even though phenomenology comes out of the late 1800s, early 1900s, it to me really does have this kind of, you know, hippies in a room meditating, focusing, you know, with some incense and some guitar or some sitar music, you know, like being in the hippie episode of Star Trek, except that it's very meditative, almost actually even more so. I picture like Spock in his quarters with, you know, with his hands together doing the Vulcan salute, you know, meditating and however Vulcans meditate. And I picture Spock doing some sort of phenomenological conceptual analysis in his mind. He's playing with different concepts, turning them over in his mind, trying to get the truth of the matter, trying different scenarios. That's how I picture Vulcan meditation going. It's something like phenomenology, but it does, to me, connote something like meditation. And I worry a bit that I read a bit too much into it, because I don't think you have to do meditation to do phenomenology. Sure. You just need to be, you need, the important thing is to focus on the mental aspects of your experience, focus on how things appear to you. And that doesn't mean you have to close your eyes and do spooky meditation to do phenomenology, but I think it's conducive to it. I think you do tend to close your eyes and say, okay, picture a starship. Now close your eyes, get to the essence of it. Now try a different picture of a starship, and what's different about it? What have you learned about the concept of a starship from doing that? To me, that sounds at least like guided meditation, if not meditation proper. And I think that actually helps rather than hurts the concept of phenomenology. So
I'm picturing Tuvok and Kes boiling tea,
doing phenomenology.
Picture the cup. Now picture the liquid inside the cup. Now picture the atoms that make up the... I mean, that's exactly what they were doing.
So, you know, for me, do I think phenomenology is the right way to do philosophy? I think probably not. I think it relies on the subjective too much, and it's too easy to read your past experience into your subjective views. It's too easy to be uncritical about your own views. It's too easy to have selective judgment and not focus on counterexamples. And the idea is that it's supposed to be sort of more of a formal conceptual analysis, that you sort of systematically go through these different permutations and systematically try to challenge your own views in almost like in a first person subjective Socratic sense, challenging your own views to try to get at the essence of a concept. But I think it's just too easy to be too subjective and rely on our intuitions and on our subjective biases rather than on our mental ability to get at the truth of a concept. I'm really skeptical that gets at the truth of the matter and isn't just a matter of pure subjectivity. So I think when you really push back against phenomenology itself, it kind of falls apart, and you do need some sort of a stronger anchor for objectivity than how things seem to our minds. You know, you need the external world, or you need some sort of abstract metaphysics. You need logical consistency. You need something that grounds your beliefs in the fact of the matter, as opposed to your what could be a purely subjective opinion of the matter. And I think phenomenology doesn't make that distinction very well. It tries to, but I think the danger is that we're just so stuck in our own heads that, and we're overwhelmed by our own biases that we can't get outside of those 100%. So I don't think that phenomenology really answers the question, the challenge of subjectivity very well. But it is fun for analyzing starships. So whether phenomenology is the final word in philosophy or not is open for debate. It certainly is useful for analyzing starships and the Star Trek universe. But Star Trek and phenomenology isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
Please sit down. Let me get my eel.
Yeah, right. It just slapped. See, now that would have been awesome if he had just like slapped the eel in Archer's face. And then Archer, that entire meaningful scene at the end of the episode, the discussion between Archer and T'Pol, if he had had a giant eel stuck to his
cheek
the entire
time. That would have been great.
The orb.
And what's so great, I think, about Star Trek Deep Space Nine is, especially with Sisko, is you get to watch somebody slowly become a believer in a faith. And it's shown as being reasonable.
Literary Treks.
The big difference is when you're doing nonfiction books, the way we do them, we do a lot of interviewing, and the interviewing requires a lot of transcribing tapes, and that's possibly the most miserable job one could ever run into. It's a real task.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all of the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
Leave us a voicemail. You can go look in the sidebar of the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
You can find us on Twitter under the handle @trekfm.
On Facebook, just go to facebook.com/trekfm. And while you're there, be sure to check out the Babel Conference. The Babel Conference is our Trek FM listeners-only discussion group. It is a closed group, but if you click join, someone will let you right on in. Just simply type the Babel Conference. That's B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Mike, when you're not doing a phenomenological analysis of the essence of a tricorder, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, I'm most active on Facebook. You can find me around the Babel Conference on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you're not performing sitar riffs in 10 Forward, where can our listeners find you around the interwebs?
Well, likewise, you can find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, if you'd like to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can also find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, @ZacharyFruehling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, and Fruehling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, our art director, and Richard Marquez, our production manager. And Mike, we want to give a special thank you to our two associate producers for Trek FM. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick under the Twitter handle @MagicDrop5. And we'd like to thank Kay Elizabeth Janeway. You can find her under the Twitter handle @ChocoWeeble. We really want to thank you both for your support of MetaTreks and Trek FM in general. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to Metatreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go phenomenologically where no philosophers have gone before.